Thank you for coming.
I'm Chris Hoover. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
And my sobriety date's August 16, 2002. My home group's the Midtown Group. And I want to thank Billy for having me out. It's an honor and privilege to be asked to speak anywhere, to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. And because believe me, it didn't start out that way, you know. And is there anyone new here tonight? First 30 days? Welcome. In case you don't know, this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And someone had to tell me that at my first meeting. I wasn't quite sure where I was or what was going on. And you found your way into a good group, and I, you know, hope you stay sober. And I love drinking. I'm not going to badmouth liquor. I love to drink. I loved everything about drinking. And, you know, I didn't plan on being Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't grow up with, you know, aspirations of being a drunk. I didn't grow up with, you know, an agenda to be incarcerated, to ruin the lives of my family, my sisters, my mother. You know, that's not what I set out to do when I was drinking. I really just set out to have a good time, you know. And drinking for a long time was a good time. You know, I've got to be honest about that. And it did for me what nothing else could do. You know, if Coca-Cola would do the same thing that booze did, I would drink Coca-Cola, you know. And I got a late start drinking. I grew up in Montgomery County. I was born in Washington, D.C. My family moved out to the suburbs. And you know, I'm not going to say, you know, I felt uncomfortable as a kid. I had a pretty normal upbringing. I had friends. We went out and played, you know. We ran around the neighborhood. We caused trouble. I was always a troublemaker. I will tell you that. And I got kicked out of every school I was ever in. And, you know, I was a class clown. I just liked cutting up. And I remember, you know, the kind of stuff that I would do is, you know, I was in this school and we had, you know, grade school, and we had two recesses, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. The kind of stuff I would do is in the morning recess, I would go out to the field where all the kids played soccer in the afternoon recess, and I would dig these holes with my friends. I'd get a couple losers like me together, and we'd go out there, dig these holes and set little traps, you know. And then at the noon recess, we would just sit on the hill and watch the kids playing soccer fall in the holes and trip and stuff like that. And I just thought that was a good time for me. That's the kind of stuff I like to get into. And, you know, it's no wonder I didn't last long anywhere I was. And I was just a class clown. I was just a nuisance and just looking for that attention, you know. And before I ever drank, I was sort of a liar and a thief. And I probably needed to drink long before I ever had one. And when I was in high school, I started getting into, you know, just stealing stuff and selling it at school. I mean, that was kind of my thing. I mean, I've never been a fan of work or a job or anything like that. And I'm always looking for maximum results for the minimum amount of effort. You know, that's the kind of guy I am. And something happened in high school. My father passed away of cancer. And he was real sick for 6 or 7 months, and you know, and this is all looking back. You know, I can see the level of self-centeredness that I had. You know, and when he was on his deathbed, you know, in my house, and my sisters were there, my mom was there taking care of him, but I was nowhere to be found. You know, I was out doing what a teenager wants to do, whatever I wanted to do. You know, and I used to tell people that. I used to believe my own lie. I used to tell people, well, I was 14, 15 years old. How am I going to deal with that? Truth was, I didn't want to be bothered, you know. And that's the level of my self-centeredness. And this is all before drink, you know. And as I got close to getting out of high school, you know, I had a few beers here and there at parties, things like that. Never really got drunk. But, you know, I got more and more into breaking into cars, stealing car stereos. You know, I had a little side business going, you know, and I eventually got arrested for that. That was my first time incarcerated. And, you know, when you're young, you get arrested, you can sort of get out of trouble, beat the charges, do a little probation, and it was not a big deal, you know. And, you know, that's just the kind of guy I was, you know. And the way I felt was, is that somebody had taken something special from me, and it felt really good to take things from other people, you know. And that's the way I felt about it. And I got out of high school, that's when my drinking picked up. And I was hanging out with a bunch of clowns just like me. And we started going downtown and going to the clubs and going to the bars and hanging out. And I remember, you know, a buddy of mine was a DJ, and he had an event in Canada, in Montreal, and he took me up there with him, you know. And I'm pretty much not doing much with my life at this point in time. Just out of high school, dropped out of Montgomery College, you know, which is a community college. And I had a little business going that I was printing some T-shirts here and there. And I just felt uncomfortable with myself when we got up to Canada, you know. And you know, we were at this bar. I mean, he's doing his thing. He's DJing up there, and he asked me, he gave me a credit card, and he asked me to go to the bar and start a tab. And I said, okay, I'll start a tab. You know, he said, order some drinks. I said, okay, what do you want to drink, you know? What should I drink? And, you know, up until this point, all I had was, you know, a beer here and there. And I told him, I don't really like the taste of beer. You know, what else can I get? And he said, well, why don't you try a vodka cranberry. I said, okay, I don't know what that is, but I like cranberry juice. It sounds good. And I've always been a sort of a tense guy, uptight guy, you know, and I used to go to these bars and things like that. I like to play pool, you know, shoot a lot of pool. And I've always been the kind of guy that has to win. You know, I got to win, and I got to be good, you know. And I'm the kind of guy that if I missed a shot, I would get upset. I would break pool sticks, you know, over the table. I would scream at people and use foul language, innocent bystanders. And I remember that night I was playing pool, and I felt the same way I always did when I was playing pool, you know. And the waitress comes over, and she starts bringing those vodka cranberries. And I'm not thinking much of it, because up until this point, you know, I have yet to feel the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. So I'm not really sure what I'm missing, you know, at this point. It's sort of like describing the beaches of Hawaii to somebody that's never been, you know. And you can sit there and nod your head and say, oh, that sounds really good, you know. But until you're actually there, walking on the beach with your, you know, feet in the sand between your toes, you're not really going to know. So the waitress brings over the vodka cranberries, and I start drinking them. And to me, you know, they just taste like, they taste good. You know, I don't mind. It agrees with me. No wonder. And I'm drinking those things, and I'm playing pool, and I'm getting frustrated. And about the third vodka cranberry, the magic starts to happen, you know. And I start noticing that my hands are getting a little, feel like they're getting swelled up and a little sweaty, you know. The room starts to soften up. Lights start to soften up, you know. And I start to feel kind of that warm sensation through my gut, you know. And then there's a sort of easiness in my step, you know, as I'm walking around the pool table, you know. I'm not rushing to find anything. I'm just sort of taking the shots, and they're going in. Everything seems to be working, you know. And she keeps bringing the drinks, and I keep drinking, you know. And the more I drink, the better I feel, which is what makes me different than a non-alcoholic, you know. There wasn't anything like, you better stop bringing those drinks, Mrs. Waitress, because I've had enough, you know. I drank whatever she brought. And, you know, and I felt great. And next thing I know, I'm shooting pool, and it doesn't matter if I win or lose, you know. And that's what alcohol did for me, you know. And to me, I don't think I realized how uncomfortable I was until I felt that sense of ease and comfort with taking a few drinks. And if you would have asked me before that night, how do you feel? I said, I feel fine. Because I don't have any reference point, you know. I just think the way I feel is the same way everyone else feels. They just seem to have some sort of coping mechanisms that are better than mine, you know. Some people play tennis or baseball or basketball. I break into cars, you know. That's what I thought, you know. Just a different path, you know. And so I wasn't really even aware that I had that restlessness, that irritability, that discomfort, and that it talks about in our literature. I wasn't even aware of it. And but I tell you what, nothing bad happened that night. You know, he finished up his gig, and you know, we took a flight home, and nothing bad happened. You know, there were no consequences. It's just a good night. Good night. And I didn't start drinking every day, you know, the next week. But my plan started to change, you know. I started to make drinking more a part of the process, you know. I started hanging out with people that drank. And I used to have a buddy. He was sort of my drinking sponsor. He had an apartment in Bethesda, and I used to go over there, and he smoked that other stuff, you know, that happens, and I would bring the bottle of liquor, and he would provide the other stuff, and we would meet over in his apartment, and we would just watch movies and drink and do that other stuff, and we're just on the couch, and you know, there's no police, there's no problems, we're just having a good time, and his girlfriend would come over and cook Spanish rice. And we'd be real hungry, so we would eat, you know what I mean? And this started happening more and more, you know. This, I would just find my way over to this guy's house, you know. Maybe it's just on Thursdays, you know. Now it's on Wednesdays, you know, and Thursdays. And maybe Sunday afternoons was a good time, too, you know. And I'm, you know, I've got this little business I've started, you know. I'm doing T-shirt printing. A trade that I taught myself when I got out of high school. And I'm making a little money, and I'm doing a lot of promotions and marketing for some of the clubs downtown. I had all these inns and these connections down there. And so now I got this job, I got this business that kind of puts me in the right place where drinking's happening, you know. Next thing I know, I'm meeting the owners of some of these places, some of these clubs. I'm meeting them early. I said, well, why don't I come down, you know, 5-6 o'clock, you know, before the club opens, you know, and we'll discuss business, which took probably like 5 minutes, you know. And mostly it was an excuse to drink. And so I'm, you know, 19, 20 years old, and I seem to have a all-access pass, you know, because this business I'm doing, and I'm going down to these clubs, and pretty soon, you know, the day job that I have, the company I have, which was going well, starts to seem less and less important, you know, because my real job is starting to happen between the hours of midnight and 6 a.m., you know, and I'm going out more, and I'm going out all night, and this is sort of overshadowing, you know, the work I got to do during the day, And all of this happened gradually over several years. You know, it didn't happen overnight. And in my mind, you know, I just always thought to myself, I just want to have a good time, you know. If people could have a good time like I'm having a good time, they would do it, you know. If they could make money and work while they're getting loaded and drunk, you know, I mean, I don't see the problem with that. And I really felt like people envied me, you know, that would try to tell me to slow down. I just thought they were jealous, you know, like, you guys don't know what you're talking about. And pretty soon that business sort of faded away because I couldn't really show up for the hours of 9 to 5 anymore. And I had to sell that business and sold it to a competitor, and it really crushed me. And I wouldn't have admitted it. I probably told myself that it was time to move on to other things, you know, which is what we do, right? But it really crushed me because you know, I have that competitive spirit. You know, I want to succeed. I want to be successful. And I've always had these dreams of being something important, you know, and doing something valuable with my life. But the problem is I just can't do it. You know, I have all this potential, but I'm full of fear and I'm afraid, you know. So if I can't really succeed from the jump, then I don't even try it, you know. And all that sort of looking back, you know, I was just full of false pride and ego, and all I would have told you was, I just need to move on. It's time for something different, time for career change. And so while I had that business, I taught myself certain skills, and I was able to get into the sort of, you know, printing and marketing and design industry, and I tried to keep jobs here and there. And if you're living the sort of lifestyle that I was living, it's really hard to stay employed, you know. And I would have jobs, and they would last probably anywhere from 3 to 6 months. And because I'm a great starter, you know. I go in on the interview, I look real sharp, you know. I've got the resume, and I can sell myself. And then after a couple months sets in, and I get comfortable, the truth comes out, you know. I'm out in the parking lot at lunchtime, you know, smoking that other stuff. I'm going to happy hour with all the sales reps, you know, 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm drinking all night long with them. So the secret starts to come out, you know. You start coming into work, and people are talking, you know. Because I partied a little differently than most people, you know. A lot of people would shut it down around 8, 9 o'clock after happy hour. I didn't shut it down, you know. It used to make me really angry when people shut it down, you know. When they used to say, well, you know, we got a big meeting tomorrow, you should probably call it quits for the night. And that used to infuriate me, you know. I used to pound my fist on the bar and say, you, let's drink, you know. And that's just the way I was, because I couldn't understand what was more important than just having a good time, you know. I just didn't understand it. And I have no idea what's happening to me. And I think that this is probably a very clear moment for me. And the book talks about it, where we cross that line between being a normal drinker and an alcoholic and a hopeless drinker. And I probably, at that point, if somebody had reined me in, I might have been able to stop. But I didn't, you know. And I kept drinking. And I was probably already smitten by alcoholism at that point. And you know, so I would lose jobs, I would get jobs, I would lose jobs. And, you know, meanwhile, the activities at night are just increasing, you know. Now that instead of 3 days a week, instead of going out Friday, Saturday, maybe Thursday, you know, there's this thing down at this club on Monday nights. I got to go down to that. Then it's Tuesday nights, and then it's Wednesday nights, and then it's Thursday nights. It just seemed like every night of the week was an excuse to drink. And I got laid off for the last time. Got laid off for the last time in 1996. And just like in Bill's story, that would be the last day of honest work for a very long time. And I did the worst thing that a lazy guy like me can do. I got on unemployment. And I got that check every month, you know. And it was just enough money to pay my bills. And, you know, but a guy like me with expensive habits needs to have a little bit more, you know. And I sort of got into the import-export business innocently enough. And again, I mean, I'm not trying to be Tony Montana. I don't want to be, you know, Pablo Escobar. I just want to have a good time, you know. And it costs money to have a good time. And this sort of really took me down. And it's like living a life without any sort of rules or guidelines, you know. Any sort of morals that I used to have sort of faded away, you know, and living this sort of life gave me an all-access pass to whatever I wanted to do, whenever I wanted to do it, and which is a terrible thing for an alcoholic like me, you know, because I already have an an ego the size of this room. You know, I already have this idea of my, this false idea of myself that I'm the most powerful thing there is, you know? And when people peel back those velvet ropes and, you know, get comped into this VIP room, comped into that VIP room, I mean, it's just, you know, it was just killing me. And, you know, and if you do what I was doing for a period of time long enough, you're going to attract some attention. Most of the attention I appreciated, but there was some attention that I did not appreciate. And in 1998, my drinking was abruptly federally interrupted. And they knocked, but they certainly did not wait for me to answer. And, you know, and that was not a good night for me. And I don't mean to make light of it, because it was a terrible situation, and not for me necessarily, but, you know, the next day I'm on Fox 5 Investigates, I'm on the news, I'm watching my own, in myself, I'm watching the newscast of the bust, you know, the arrest. And I didn't think for one minute that if I'm watching that, my mom's probably watching it too, and my sister's. And my neighbors, people that knew my family, people that knew my dad before he passed away. And not once did I ever think about that, you know. I'm just sitting in general population with a bunch of other losers talking about, aha, look at that, that's me, you know. And for maybe some people, that incident right there would be enough to maybe stop drinking, you know. But not for an alcoholic my type. You know, I didn't really consider not drinking at all, you know. I considered maybe slowing down on these other things, maybe getting out of the import-export business. That's what I considered. But I never considered not drinking, you know. But I didn't think I had a problem with drinking. And I paid a lawyer a lot of money, and I got out of trouble, beat the charge, you know. I did 6 months incarcerated. And then I did 6 months on house arrest, you know. Now, the first thing I did when I got on house arrest is I called up a doctor. And I said, Doc, I'm feeling a little anxious these days, you know. You got anything for that? Of course, the doctor does, you know, as many doctors do. Because I know I can't drink, right? So here I am with an ankle bracelet, house arrest, blowing into this thing every now and then. And I'm still getting messed up, you know. And I don't think anything of it. And the minute they cut that thing off my ankle, it's time to celebrate. And I met my friends up at TGI Fridays, and we started drinking. And, you know, and at this point, I tried to say to myself, I said, well, I'm going to drink tonight, but I'm not going to do those other things, you know. And that didn't last but maybe 3 hours, you know. And as soon as the effect alcohol has on me starts to settle in, then all bets are off as far as I'm concerned, you know. And then I started playing that game, as some of us might have done, and said, well, it's midnight now. If I do this other stuff, I've got 72 hours and I don't have to go for a pee test till Tuesday, you know. And then midnight comes and goes, and it's 6 a.m. And then I'm really counting the hours. Well, now it's exactly 72 hours, you know. And I danced around like this for a year and a half, you know, dodging my PO, dodging probation. And things did not get better for me in that year and a half. They really got worse. And because now I'm starting to get this idea that I'm sort of caught in a trap I can't spring, you know. And I'm no longer drinking to have fun, to just have fun, but I'm drinking to forget. I'm drinking because I need it. I'm drinking because I cannot live my life sober. I can't be under all this pressure from the lawyers, the DA, my family, my sisters, all the hopes and dreams and businesses that I threw away. I can no longer live sober with this information in my head, and I've got to drink. I've got to. And And I'm starting to see this. And my and pretty soon, gone were the fancy clubs, gone were the velvet ropes, gone were the beautiful girls at all these fancy places. Pretty soon, it's just me and I'm drinking. Drinking in a basement, you know. And it got so bad for me that I became paranoid. And I had to literally pay people to go out and buy me food. You know, I was terrified to go out. And I'm sitting in this basement, and I'm pretty much just drinking myself in and out of consciousness, you know. And I had a little dog at the time. And I remember this one night very vividly. And I went and bought myself some of that other stuff, you know. And I was thinking that if I buy enough of it, maybe I can sell a little bit to get some drinking money. You know, big mistake. You know, big mistake. And I go back to my basement apartment with my dog. I've got a bottle of rum, which I like, Bacardi. And I'm just pouring myself drinks, and I'm doing this other stuff. And this other stuff starts getting out of control, and I hide it in the drop ceiling, you know, in my basement apartment. And I keep drinking. And then a half hour later, I'm tearing down the drop ceiling looking for it, you know. And I'm laying on this futon, you know, and didn't really have a bed at the time. And I'm going in and out of consciousness. I'm passing out. That's what's happening. And I have this dream, and I see this long stairway as I'm passing out. And at the top of the stairway, it's black. It's just black. And I'm thinking to myself, if I go up that stairway in my dream, I'm a dead man, you know. And my dog's laying in the futon with me, and my dog keeps kicking me. And I'm coming to when he kicks me, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to die, you know. Really, I'm going to die. And I don't know how I made it out that night. I mean, I probably passed out at some point, you know. And that's really where my drinking had taken me, you know. All alone. In a basement apartment, drinking myself to death. And thank God, you know, God intervened, you know. And I violated probation eventually with 32 dirty urines. And took some time for them to catch up with me. I mean, at the end, I just gave up. I mean, I was just, you know, and I knew. I mean, I knew. I mean, I almost welcomed the idea. I almost welcomed the idea because at this point, I mean, I had lost hope, you know. I knew there was no way I could stop. And they finally violated me and set a date for sentencing. And here I go, and I show up in front of this judge again. And the last time I saw him, he said he was going to give me all my backup time, which was 5 years, 4.5 years. Funny thing is, my judge happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, although I didn't know that until I got out, got sober later on. And he knew what was wrong with me. And I don't really remember that sentencing day because it's a little fuzzy. You know, I remember taking a handful of Xanax before I went to court and drinking a last bit of Grand Marnier that my sister had for cooking. But I do remember coming to in the holding cell after I had been sentenced. And most people will probably feel a little nervous about being in a holding cell not knowing how much time they got. You know, I did not feel nervous at all. You know, I felt such a sense of relief, you know, when coming to in that cell. Such an incredible sense of relief. And it wasn't because I was hiding from anybody or running from anybody. I didn't owe anybody any money. You know, is because I knew that for at least a period of time that I couldn't kill myself anymore. Because I knew that it was over, you know, the party was over. And that's really, you know, and I said a prayer. I said, God, please help me, you know. And that, I think, is where my sobriety took off. And I detoxed on a cell floor in general population. They call it the beach. They ran out of cells for people, so they just put you out in a common room like this, and you're with everybody, you know. And I'm just sweating, and, you know, it's freezing cold in there. I guess they don't have heat. And I can't eat anything for days, you know, for weeks. And the judge knew better than me, being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he sentenced me to this treatment program while I was incarcerated. And that's really where Alcoholics Anonymous was presented to me for the first time. Now, I had gone to meetings here and there to get slip signed, but nothing, really, there wasn't any desperation there. See, it didn't apply to me because I'm not an alcoholic, you know. And I've got some other problems, you know, but I'm not an alcoholic. And the truth was, I really didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anything about what it means to be an alcoholic. And I just had this idea that an alcoholic is someone who drank under a bridge out of a paper bag, you know, and that wasn't me. And I didn't have a family to lose, so I didn't lose a family. I didn't have a car, so I didn't lose a car. And I started going to AA meetings while I was incarcerated, not because I wanted to, because I was mandated to while I was in jail, which I didn't think they could do. I thought once you're in jail, they really can't. I mean, you're in jail, isn't that bad enough? But apparently they can pretty much do anything. And that was my first experience with sort of a power greater than myself, was the court system and the jail that I was in. And I started going to these meetings, and, you know, my head cleared for the first time. I was in there for about 2 years, and I had never been sober for, like, longer than 6 months. I mean, it had been 10 years since I'd been sober longer than 6 months, and my head started to clear, and I had to get off all that medication. They put me on this antipsychotic medication, and I got off all that stuff, and my head started to clear, and I started to listen to meetings. And there was an old guy that used to bring meetings in, and he was part of H&I. His name was Russ, and he had bad cataracts in his eyes. He could barely see, but every Thursday night he brought a meeting in to that institution, and I got to know this guy, and he sort of 12-stepped me, you know. He told me his experience, you know, and he said, you don't ever have to be back to this place again, you know. And I had not considered, even though it was the third or fourth time that I had been incarcerated, that I never considered that I was coming back. I always thought that I wasn't coming back, you know. And that was part of my problem, you know. Because I do great while I'm incarcerated. I do great while I'm institutionalized. I do great when someone else is managing my life. But eventually they open those doors. And you're going to walk out. And then what? What's going to happen? You know? And that was always my problem, you know. As soon as I start calling the shots, it starts going south really quick. And I started listening to this guy, and I started believing what he was telling me. And I felt better in there. I felt good, you know. I was able to sleep at night, for the first time in a long time. Now I was still haunted by those visions, those people I hurt, those things I did while I was out there. I was constantly haunted by these things. The remorse and guilt that I felt for all the people I had hurt. Because I wasn't a nice guy, you know. I remember I was at a party one time when I was drinking, and there was a girl ODing right on the floor in front of me, turning blue, foaming at the mouth, you know. I didn't think to call the ambulance, call for help. I just turned to my friend and I said, hey, man, we better get out of here before the party gets busted. And I stepped right over here and walked out the door, you know. She's probably ODing on drugs I gave her. That's the truth. That's the animal that I was out there. And those are the things I would see every time I closed my eyes. I would see my sick father on a sick bed and know that I didn't show up for him. I knew it, you know, that I lost that opportunity. And I got out. I got out finally. They opened the doors, let me out, put me in the pre-release center, which is where I met the speaker you had last week, Craig D. And yeah, she gave me this big book. And that guy really saved my life. He introduced me to my sponsor. He introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. There was that transition that I needed so desperately, you know, because I knew I was getting out of the pre-release center. I knew they were going to open those doors. And for the first time, I was terrified, you know, because I knew that I was beaten. And I knew that if I get out and I do the same thing that I've always done, I'm going to be right back where I was. And it terrified me. And now I still didn't know anything about alcoholism, but I knew that something had to change. Something had to change. And when I met my sponsor, he told me a story, you know, and the story didn't match the person, you know. And that's what really intrigued me. That's, I think, the message of depth and weight that it talks about. That's that sort of intangible thing about alcoholics in recovery that can't be measured, that sort of peace and that tranquility that they have, that I saw in him. I mean, he certainly wasn't selling dummy bags in Spanish Harlem anymore, you know. I mean, he was here talking to me about a new way of life, you know. And I asked him to be my sponsor. I've only had one sponsor. And we got into the book right away. The first thing he had me read was the doctor's opinion. And I had never heard anything in my life describe alcoholism to me. I always felt it, but I had never heard it described. And I just want to read this, since we do have someone that's new here tonight. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Well, hell yeah. Absolutely. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they can after a time differentiate the true from the false. And that was me. You know? That's me in that basement apartment. Terrified to go out in the real world. You know? I remember one time, man, I couldn't get anyone to buy me any food, couldn't get anyone to deliver, and I actually had to go out on a Sunday afternoon, in the middle of the day. Terrifying. I remember getting in my car and driving to McDonald's, and it was a beautiful Sunday afternoon. People were out mowing the lawn, walking the dogs, and I felt like I was on another planet. You know, I felt so alienated from the rest of the world, you know, because I had... I mean, that wasn't, that life was for other people, wasn't for me, you know. I could not differentiate the true from the false. To them, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. And that's true. I used to hate people that I drank with. They weren't in jail. They didn't end up in AA. God. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless the person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. And that... the psychic change is what I'm interested in today. That's what I've been interested in. And I think that if I could provide myself with that psychic change, I wouldn't be standing here talking to you. That's for sure. I wouldn't have driven 2.5 hours out here to talk to you guys and eat at the Pig and Steak. You know? But I don't have that ability. You know? And I've made many, many promises that I couldn't fulfill on. You know? Drinking, just not drinking, just being one of the many, you know. And so my sponsor got me into this book, and we did a fourth and fifth step right away. We didn't waste any time. He knew that there were some things in here that had to come out. And a fourth and fifth step, you'll hear a lot of things about fourth and fifth step. People feel great. They feel like they've been touched by the hand of God, and they're walking through the sunlight of the Spirit, hand in hand with the rest of the people around them. I did not feel that way. Okay? I don't know about you, but I drank to forget that stuff. Okay? My entire drinking career, at least the latter part, was in desperate attempt to not face those things about myself, you know? Those very things I wrote on that paper were the same things I drank to forget, you know. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, just like it says in the book, I couldn't differentiate the true from the false. I had blocked some of those things out so much that when I wrote those things down on that paper, I felt sick to my stomach. Because there was me. That was me. Couldn't argue with it. I wrote it. my inventory. And I sort of liken it to when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you're sort of in a cave with no exit, but the lights are off, so you're unaware there's no exit. So you're sort of just dancing around, you know, having fun. Things are great. I'm sober. Feel better, work better, look better. Doing a fourth and fifth step, it's like someone has snapped on the lights and now you're aware you're in a cave with no exit. At least that's how I felt, you know. And but I did have a connection with my sponsor. And I knew that finally someone knows everything there is to know about me. And there was some relief in that. And I felt good about that. And for me, the relief really came when I got involved with the eighth and ninth step. And to me, this is probably the most important step in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is where I really get to do something about those nightmares I have every time I close my eyes. And this is where I really need to straighten out the wreckage of my past, you know, which are those very things I drank over. And I'll tell you about some of the amends I made. And the first amend I made was my father, you know, and I was instructed to write a letter to him, catching him up on all the years that had gone by since he passed away. Now, I'm 30 years old, and he died when I was 14. That's a lot of writing, you know. And I wrote that letter. And in that letter, to be honest with you, was not a lot of great stuff. I mean, I didn't have anything happy to report to my father from the grave, you know. Hadn't graduated anything. Just been incarcerated 4 times. Committed a lot of felonies, you know. Broke mom's heart. Broke the sister's hearts, you know. Been basically a derelict for most of my life. The end. You know? And I took that letter and I read it at his gravesite with my sponsor right next to me and a guy I sponsored to the left. You know? And for me, I hadn't been to my dad's gravesite since he was buried. Because I don't want to go back. You know? And he was buried 10 minutes from where I live. Right down the street. Now, people get different. I didn't know what to expect by making amends, you know. My sponsor told me to do it. I believed that maybe something good could happen. I didn't know what to expect, you know. And in this case, for this amend, that I can now drive past that cemetery and I didn't have to look the other way, you know. And every Father's Day I go and I put my chip there. I clean off his grave, you know. And the book says there may be some wrongs we may never fully right. And I don't think that, you know, the book also says we shall not regret the past nor shall shut the door. And I don't think I've shut the door on that, but I can't tell you that I still don't regret that. If I could take that back, that time with my father where he was sick and be there at his bedside, I would take it back. I regret it, you know. But there are things that I've been able to do in Alcoholics Anonymous that haven't taken it away, but have made it livable, you know? And that's why I work with so many newcomers. Maybe I can help them to not repeat what I've gone through. Maybe they can make right with their family before they pass on. And another amend I made was to my mother, you know? These are the big ones. These are people who love and trusted me. And I took her on a trip to New Mexico. I had already paid her back all the money I ripped her off for. And I was showing up in her life for many years. You know, this is probably about 3 years sober I did this. And I took her on a trip to New Mexico. She always wanted to go. And we're just driving down beautiful scenery, Arizona, New Mexico. Just these roads, as long as they're just straight. You know, and you could just see, as far as the eye can see, we're just driving, and she's just talking about, you know, when she was a young woman in Washington, D.C., before she met my father, and she's telling me about her life, and we're just having a good time, you know, just me and her. And I'm just doing whatever she wants to do. Wherever she wants to go, whatever she wants to do is what we're doing, you know. And I don't have an agenda or anything that I need to do. It's just to be with her. And somewhere along that road, you know, I said, Mom, I'm sorry, you know. And whatever I can do to make it right, I want to do. And she said, just keep doing what you're doing, you know. And since then, you know, I mean, it's just the relationship has just come full circle, you know. And these are the things I felt terrible about. I mean, she's the one who watched her own son on the news, you know. She knew. Embarrassed her in front of all her neighbors and her friends. And since then, you know, I mean, she's just the sweetest lady ever could be. And she's retired. She doesn't have a lot of money, so I take care of her financially, you know. She's, you know, she's pretty funny. I gave her a credit card the other week. I said, Mom, just whatever you need, you just use this card. You know, I'll pay the bill. And she used to call me every time she made a purchase, you know. Hey, I spent $5 on this. Hey, I spent $5 on that. And I said, Mom, stop calling me. You know, just use the card and I'll pay the bill, you know. And I can't tell you that. I mean, that, it just, you know, I want to know that my mother is comfortable and she's got everything she needs, you know. Because I know that I can't possibly, you know, in one lifetime pay back all that I've taken to her. There's no way. And I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about the emotional stuff that I've taken. And but I do the best I can. And another amend I made that was really just blew me away was, and this one I waited a long time into sobriety to do this, but it was to a woman that I dated for many, many years and while I was drinking. Really treated her poorly. And I dated her for about 4 years. And I just made this amend actually last year. So I've been about 5 years sober. And I waited a while because that's what my sponsor told me to do. And I don't think that I could have really seen the importance of it until then. And I met up with this woman. She sort of reappeared in my life as things happened with amends. And she called me up. You know, I talked. Said, we'll meet up for some coffee. And we met up for some coffee. And I'm just sipping my coffee. And she goes into this tirade about all the bum men she's dated over the last 10 years, you know. She's telling me about this relationship and how terrible it was in this relationship and this relationship, and she was divorced and then she dated, you know. I mean, it went on for about an hour, and I, you know, and I'm sitting there and I'm just, I mean I'm shocked, you know, because I don't think she knew what she was saying, but I knew that I had something to do with that. That I set the precedence for this young girl when we dated. And now, this was the result. Now, I don't think that I have that kind of power over people to change their lives to that degree. But I know that there were... I mean, I know that something happened there, you know. And what occurred to me was that when I harm someone, you don't know how far those ripples go and how many people those ripples touch. You know, and it really magnified the sort of harms that I created when I was drinking, you know, because I just never looked at it that way, you know. And you don't know how far the rabbit hole goes, how deep it goes. And I think what has happened because I have been willing to straighten out the wreckage of my past is that I no longer walk around in a world that I don't feel like I belong in, you know. I can look people in the eye. I can look the world in the eye. And when I lay my head down at night, I don't see those nightmares anymore, you know. And I don't feel terrible about the person I used to be, you know. And a funny thing started happening once I started making those amends is that newcomers really started to show up in my life, you know. And I think they were always there, but I think the ability that I had to really listen to somebody and really not want anything in return was impossible until I had cleared up the wreckage of the past. I mean, that's the truth. And because no matter what I did before that, I'm always got this tape running back here that you're not good enough. You're a criminal. You know, I don't feel like a criminal anymore. You know, that's the truth. Because I made amends to that judge. I wrote him a letter. And the letter was really about being able to get back into the same institution, same place that I was got sober in, and bring meetings like that guy brought meetings to me. That's really what I wanted to do. And I know that there was a time limit on that. And this is about 3 years sober. I wasn't even off probation. And I wrote this letter to the judge. And I had seen him in AA meetings. You know, and he had seen me. Because he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he basically wrote me a letter and said, he basically took me off probation right there and then, you know, ended my probation. I would have been on probation another year, which would have extended the time that I could go back into those institutions a year, you know. And since then, he and I have a great relationship, you know. And that's, eventually I hope to get a full and complete pardon, you know, down the road. And but really, making those amends has allowed me to be a part of other people's lives. I'm not afraid. You know, I'm not afraid to love someone. I'm not afraid to be loved. I don't have to have disclaimers on everything. Well, I'll love you, but I want this. You know, I don't seek gratification and all these outside things anymore. AA has filled me up to the point where I often don't want anything. You know, my girlfriend asks me all the time, what do you want? I don't want anything. What do you want for your birthday? Nothing. I don't want anything. You know, I've got everything I could possibly need. When I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought that the best thing the AA could do was replace the feelings I had when I was drinking. That's pretty good, right? If that's all AA did, that would be pretty good. I would take that. But having worked the steps and working with other alcoholics, making these amends, cleaning up the wreckage of the past, having these relationships in my life that mean so much to me, I know that there's no way drinking could replace the feelings of joy and compassion that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now that is a psychic change. If that's not a psychic change, I don't know what's a psychic change. Okay? That's a change in outlook. And for a loser like me, for an alcoholic of my type, to have that happen is nothing short of a miracle, you know. And I know God's looking out for me. You know I have a higher power in my life today. And there's no way that the things that have happened in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous could be explained any other way. And I didn't get here thinking that, you know. So if you're new, I hope that you really give this a shot. If you're tired, you know, just tired. Tired of the grind out there, then I hope you give this a shot and get a sponsor and read this book. It will change your life. And thanks, Billy, for having me out. I think I'm done. Thanks.